This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today, we're going to start with a discussion about a common frustration among people with disabilities. It's that other people can't seem to see beyond the disability. An upcoming exhibition, Artists First, aims to challenge perceptions and raise awareness about accessibility at museums as well. Sherry Shirek founded Arts Access for All after losing her sight to diabetes. Her husband, Jesse, with low vision since birth, is an artist. They say most arts organizations they work with are genuinely interested in making accessible spaces, even if they face budget limits. And as we learn in this conversation with our Ashley Thornburg, their work is also about empowering people with disabilities to make their needs known.
They didn't feel comfortable going into some places, not feeling welcome or feeling like they're being treated differently. We had a 12-month training, and each month we focused on a different disability, so then the arts community could learn more specifically about disabilities, just to have some more understanding and compassion.
Some things that pop into my mind, we see ramps at places, and we have seen people who are able to work in sign language and do some work within that community. I wonder if there are some elements that you can talk about that some people, myself included, just it wouldn't even occur to us to think about this.
When I lived in Minneapolis, I would go to the Institute of Art. I walked around without a cane, so I didn't have a visible disability unless somebody looked at my eyes. They might be able to tell something was up. So I would get really close to the pieces of artwork to see them, and then I'd have security guards following me around the museum trying to make sure I'm not doing anything inappropriate, but also I felt like they were trying to intimidate me. It was always very hard for me to see the title and the artist who's creating a particular artwork. But now, if I were to go into that same museum, I would request audio description. It helps me fill in the gaps. I might be able to see what's pictured in, say, a Picasso painting, but there are pieces of it that I'm missing. That description helps my brain interpret what's there. It's a much more enriching experience.
I myself have gotten followed around, but sure. For touching the art, and you're not supposed to do that, but I'm kind of a tactile learner. That's wouldn't fall under this purview exactly. Even if you are only looking at it from the perspective of how people learn differently and take in that information, is there some overlap there?
One of the ways of accommodating a person with vision loss might help a tactile learner. There's a couple of ways of doing, say, a touch tour. We had an opportunity to touch a sculpture of Picasso's goat. How many people get to do that? You could certainly have a replica of a sculpture on a smaller scale that could be handled so that it would be touchable. And then there's also three-dimensional pieces of work that can be taken from a two-dimensional image. Also, when you touch it, sometimes audio will play and give you more information about what you're touching.
Wow. Sherry, you have been active in this community for a long time. How do you feel about the trajectory?
Improvements are being made. For instance, the FMCG now has sensory-friendly shows. I know that the Plains does a lot of that. There's a lot more awareness. The Arts Partnership is very much in support of this. Changes are happening. It's being talked about more. It's more out there. And I'm keeping it moving. Make sure we meet regularly, that we always have some sort of project going.
What is the show that you are working on right now?
It's called Artists First. We wanted to give people with disabilities the opportunity to enter their artwork into an art show that was juried, go through the process, understand what it is all about, and feel safe and comfortable. People with disabilities, they don't want to identify as a person with a disability. That isn't the whole person. I want people to take me seriously. I don't want to be coddled. I don't want to be told I'm amazing because I have a disability and I can do things that other people can do. It's kind of hard because it's about expectations. Do people expect people with disabilities to be able to do amazing work? And if you think about famous artists, Monet had blindness, Van Gogh had mental illness.
Let's talk about the work that you are creating for the show.
I'm doing a series of paintings that have lotus flowers floating on the water. The idea is that, you know, they're not going to be necessarily a realistic image of a lotus flower. It's not going to look like a photograph. I would be able to create a painting that would look like a photograph. But the intention is help the viewer understand, why is this an image of a lotus flower? Like, what does this mean? Where's the symbolism? When I create artwork, it's an interesting process because there's a dynamic there with me as a person who's legally blind creating artwork that's primarily visual. So there's always this disconnect of what is the person with perfect vision seeing versus what am I seeing, and how do I relay that message? So as a young person, I wanted to create perfection. I wanted to be able to create artwork that was indistinguishable from a person with perfect eyesight. Mm-hmm. And I was able to accomplish that using magnification. But I came to realize that as I studied art, that art isn't necessarily about having things perfect. There was an artist from Minneapolis. His name is Sean Conaty. And he would create these phenomenal works where he would take brush from the environment. And he had these 20 by 20 foot panels. And he'd put oil paint over the top of them, like a dark brown oil paint. And then he'd put the leaves down over the oil paint. And he'd take paper and he'd, you know, walk all over these panels. And then when it dried, he'd peel all the leaves off of the picture, kind of the idea of looking at clouds. I mean, I was fascinated by that. I thought abstraction was just ridiculous until that point. But looking at, you know, surrealist works like Dali with the melting clocks, it really got my brain going in terms of how can you carve out an image out of nothing? How can you make something emerge that isn't there? And so I really dove into that and started creating these works that it's like almost an alternate universe or a different planet or something under the sea that doesn't exist. There's dimension to it, but it's for the most part unrecognizable forms. And I found that really interesting because I was the creator. Mm-hmm. I could pull something out of this chaos that nobody else could see until I created it. So there was like a meditation almost that would take place.
That's so beautiful. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Before the interview started, your wife was showing me some of the adaptive technology that she uses in her work. You touched on this a little bit when you talked about how with low vision you were able to do magnification. Mm-hmm. But I wonder about some of the other adaptive technology that might be specific in the art world.
When I was in college, I studied art. I remember showing up to my first drawing class. And when I was in high school and doing art classes, we would sort of copy from photographs. Mm-hmm. But on the college level, you don't do that. The instructor will put up like a series of like wine bottles on different platforms, and you have to draw those or you have to paint those. And so I had this dilemma. I'm sitting 20 feet away from those wine bottles and they look like a blur to me. Or there's a person, you know, standing there in a figure drawing class and I see a blur. So how do I recreate this? One of the things that I would do is I would use, it's called a telescope, and it essentially is like binoculars, but there's one instead of two. And so the telescope that I use is a 10 powered telescope, and it lets you zoom in on the subject. And you can focus it and make it crystal clear. But then the dilemma is I'm only seeing one piece at a time. Mm-hmm. So it was like, how do I tie these pieces together? Mm-hmm. And I found techniques. So I would go back and forth between, you know, drawing what I could see of the blurred object with my normal eyesight and then using the telescope to zoom in and see the details and the gradation and shadows and color. And so it was a matter of putting those pieces together. So that was my primary tool for assistive technology. The other piece that I used a lot was a handheld magnifier. So if I was doing a sketch, you know, with a sketch, you want to keep the lines really faint, you know, because you don't want the lines to show. But, you know, with my vision, I have a hard time seeing thin lines. It's like making a map. You know, you make the sketch, it's a map. But then when it comes time to fill in the sketch, I'd use a magnifier to find those visual landmarks on the paper.
Sherry, you are fully blind. Mm-hmm. How do you experience your husband's work?
Through touch. He made me an amazing painting for my birthday, and he made it tactile. I remember color because I haven't always been blind. So having the colors described and that I can see it in my mind's eye. I listen to what he tells me about the experience of creating the art. The first piece of art he made for me, I just cried. I couldn't believe.
The piece itself is an interpretation of the painting of Starry Nights by Van Gogh. You don't see much of the landscape. So the horizon line is really low in the picture. And off to the right is a maple tree with like orange colors, but there's also greens and other spotted colors in there. And off to the left is the full moon. And I added texture to the moon so that it's dotted and there's almost a swirling pattern to the moon. The sky is like this sea of swirling colors, greens and oranges and blues coming at you. They're almost dancing in the sky. So I took this idea, this chaos that Van Gogh had worked on, and tried to interpret it as love rather than chaos. The reason I interpreted the Van Gogh painting is because when we were in New York, we went to MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art. We had an audio described tour, and the one painting that I really wanted to see there was Starry Nights. This might sound crazy, but I could feel energy in the space in front of this painting. I've never felt anything like this before, but it was like a vibration. It was a vibration throughout my entire body. And after I felt this vibration, as she was talking, all of a sudden I felt this wave of sorrow wash from my head to my feet. Sherry said to me, "Did you feel that?"
I can feel an energy from it. When it was hanging on the wall in the living room, I could just feel it when I walked in the room, like in my body, in the room. It was a sense of love and warmth. And I would always kind of go up and touch it. But just knowing it's there and it was in my mind, it's like a body sensation. But that Van Gogh, that was... What was that? It was...
That sounds better than looking at it, frankly.
Yes, it was.
When did you lose your vision?
I was 23. I was in college. And it was caused from diabetes. Oh. Yep. I was sent immediately to rehabilitation to learn how to get my life back. So I didn't have time to think, I'm blind, what am I going to do? I didn't have time to go through that depression. Yeah, I mean, I've been blind for more years than I've been sighted. I got a pancreas transplant and it cured my diabetes.
Oh, wow.
And I just had the anniversary, the 18 years of my kidney transplant. So I have two transplanted organs in my body that are functioning really well. I haven't been on insulin for, it'll be 18 years in March.
If there were a surgery to restore the vision, would you do it?
You know, at this point, I think it would be very strange. Yes, I would. But I think there would be a lot of adapting. Because I'm so used to the way I live now, it's just natural. And especially with the computer, my gosh, I would have to learn it visually. I think that would be really challenging because everything is like through listening, and the way I navigate is very different.
You get sucked in those vortex of those visuals of cat videos, and then there's your whole Saturday. What is your story? Have you had this vision condition since birth?
I was born with cataracts. It wasn't detected until I was about 3 months old. My eyes started losing muscle control. And of course, my parents just freaked out. They took me to an eye doctor and they did a number of surgeries. The result was that I had no vision in my right eye, reduced vision in my left eye because they took the lens out. After they took the lens out, my iris wouldn't dilate. My whole eye was like blue. It wouldn't open up. My iris. So they had to cut the muscle of the iris to make it open up. But then my eyes were fully dilated all the time. You know, think about going to the eye doctor and your eyes are dilated.
Yeah.
As a teenager, I started to develop glaucoma, which is like the pressure inside of your eye. And essentially with glaucoma, your eye has a certain eye pressure. Normal is like 20. Mine started creeping up towards 30. And then all of a sudden I had a retinal detachment. So the back of my eye, the retina detached partially, and I started seeing these psychedelic colors. Had that repaired, but I lost a lot of vision in the lower half of my eye. I had a hard time in school. You know, when I was young, they didn't really realize that I couldn't see very well until I was in second grade. I think it was just like, oh, he doesn't see very well. We can't really fix it. But I think I was smart enough where I could adapt to most things. I was a good listener. I could adapt to most things except for math. And I was having a really hard time with reading. Then my parents took me to the School for the Blind in Grand Forks, which at the time was a residential school. Mm-hmm. They were able to, you know, teach me how to multiply and do math. And in some ways, it was a really good experience because it helped me catch up and go back to the public school system. Mm-hmm. You know, the one thing is I started learning Braille. And the one thing about Braille is that people don't really think it's, if you can see something, they don't think it's necessary. Mm-hmm. In our culture, eyesight is the predominant sense. Mm-hmm. So they started teaching me Braille and I was doing pretty well with it, but I was reversing a lot of the letters. And so they thought, well, let's just teach him how to read print with magnification. Mm-hmm. And the reality of it was that I never, as a child, learned how to read print. You know, I tried and I struggled and they just kind of gave up on it. You know, so I was labeled as like learning disabled and I couldn't spell. And I went back into the public school systems and I did well in school. Like, I mean, I think I didn't do excellent, but I graduated with like a 3.0. So, you know, I think I slid by, but then it was time for college and I struggled initially. You know, I went to UND and I just had a lot more fun hanging out with people than I did in class. They didn't welcome me back the following year. So I went to school in Wahpeton and started studying computers. And I'd always had a love for like technology and figuring things out. I think what taught me how to read was the internet. In 1997, you know, there were a lot of web pages and I was interested in what was out there. So I would just slowly read. I think I became a better reader. You know, it was slow, but I was able to do it. I was able to teach myself how to read. Graduated from that program and went on to college at the U of M in Minneapolis, which is ironically a writing intensive university. So there's a lot of writing. And it's interesting because I've gotten to the point where I love to write now. I mean, I do a lot of writing. To circle this all back, I think people are so afraid of vision loss. Mm-hmm. I can understand that because most of the things we do are visual. Mm-hmm. But think about how many things some professionals do non-visually. Like think about going to the doctor. How much of when they examine you is actually using their eyes? Mm-hmm. They're taking your pulse, they're feeling your abdomen, they're listening to your heart. Those are all non-visual skills. Mm-hmm. There is a way to do everything non-visually. We haven't figured out how to drive yet. We're working on that.
Well, autonomous vehicles are right on the way. So
she needs to hurry up.
I can't wait.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you for listening to us. Love to help the public understand that there's a lot more out there than you think.
Life isn't over. You can live a fulfilling, happy life and live the life you want.
Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talking with Sherry and Jesse Shirick, co-organizers of Artists First, an exhibition featuring work from artists with disabilities. And there's still time to apply. The submission deadline is Monday. You can find out more at artsafa.org. That's artsafa.org. Next on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
I was in my early 20s, and I'd been a total loser in school, but the world of musicians had welcomed me. It didn't matter what I looked like or what I sounded like. I could say the craziest, dumbest things at all. It didn't matter if I couldn't talk to girls, if I could talk to guitars. That was good enough.
This week, stories of feeling out of step with the world. That's The Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
The Moth Radio Hour coming up this afternoon at 2 Central, 1 Mountain on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura is a former biology professor and the author of the Natural North Dakota essays you hear on Prairie Public. Today, his essay is about black bears.
Bears have been in the news recently. A black bear, or perhaps more than one, has been observed in the Turtle Mountains. A video recording of one episode even ran on one of the region's television stations. Black bears in the region are not particularly unusual. They're periodically observed in the Turtle Mountains and other areas of North Dakota, particularly along the northeastern part of the state and the Red River Valley. Most of these bears are thought to have wandered into the state from adjacent Minnesota or perhaps Manitoba. Art Bailey, in his A Biological Survey of North Dakota from 1926, noted that black bears historically ranged over all of North Dakota. They're probably most abundant in the Red River Valley, and also abundant in the Turtle Mountains, Pemmida Hills, and along wooded streams in the eastern part of the state. Bailey quotes Alexander Henry's journal from near the mouth of the Park River in 1800, and I quote here, "Bears make prodigious ravages in the brush and the willows. The plum trees are torn to pieces, and every tree that bears fruit has the shared same fate. The tops of the oak trees are also very roughly handled, broken, and torn down to get to the acorns. The havoc they commit is astonishing. Their dung lies about in the woods, as plentiful as that of the buffalo in the meadow." End of quote. Bailey also notes that Henry took in 906 skins over an 8-year period, likely 1800 to 1808, with locations in the Red River, Park River, near Grand Forks, Pemmida Hills, and along the Turtle River and elsewhere. Bailey also noted that in the early 1900, bears were reported in the Turtle Mountains and Pemmida Hills, Red River Valley, near Grafton, Drayton, and the Devil's Lake area. By the time of his writing in 1926, there were still a few in the Turtle Mountains, Pemmida Hills, and the Red River Valley. It's safe to say there'll be more bear sightings in the future. As for a resident population, well, time will tell. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, our Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson will join us for a discussion of the week's big stories, and Matt Olean reviews the new movie, Dr. Sleep. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Fargo man was arrested after he fired a shot toward police who responded to a report of a man with a gun in downtown Fargo just before 4 this morning. 54-year-old Henry Aiken fired his revolver outside the Radisson Hotel after he crashed his car into Gate City Bank.
Upon their arrival, an officer reported seeing a green laser being pointed in all sorts of different directions. The officer saw a male holding a gun with a laser outside in front of the entrance of the Radisson Hotel.
Police Chief Dave Todd says Aiken then fired multiple shots into the lobby of the Radisson. Some hotel employees were in the lobby at the time. They locked themselves in an office while officers apprehended Aiken at gunpoint in the lobby. While officers were setting up a perimeter during the gunfire, Sergeant Matt Eustabo was wounded in the hand when his rifle accidentally discharged, and he was rushed to the hospital. Chief Todd says the injury is serious, but not life-threatening. The director of North Dakota's medical marijuana program says the process of establishing marijuana dispensaries is about to be finalized.
Right now, the eighth and final dispensary within the medical marijuana program is on track to open up in December. That'll be the final dispensary then that is operational under the program. It will be known as Herbology of Dickinson.
Jason Wall says if the dispensary makes the December timeline, it would mark the opening of all eight designated dispensaries in less than a year's time. The first dispensary opened in Fargo on March 1st. Also complete is the development of the two manufacturing facilities.
When we started dispensing March 1, Pierre Dakota, the manufacturing facility in Bismarck, was the manufacturing facility and the only manufacturing facility with product availability. And they have done a very good job at making available more than adequate supply to these dispensaries. Starting in about mid-September, the second manufacturing facility, Grassroots in Fargo, was able to come to market with a limited number of products as well now.
Wall says the manufacturing facilities have been able to generate what he calls more than adequate supply. He says that doesn't mean there haven't been some hiccups along the way.
While a dispensary may have been, you know, short on a specific strain or maybe a certain product type, it certainly was not in relation to the manufacturing facility, you know, not being able to give an adequate supply or have a dispensary purchase an adequate supply from them.
Wall says doctors have approved more than 1,700 requests by patients looking to be eligible to buy the products. He says the number increases every week. And North Dakota oil and gas producers are facing a challenge, how to capture more natural gas and reduce flaring. That's the subject of a hearing today in Bismarck. North Dakota Pipeline Authority Director Justin Kringstead says several solutions are being explored to help reduce flaring.
Right now, the immediate need is at the localized scale, additional gathering pipeline systems, additional processing out in the field. As we look ahead 3, 5, 10 years, there's some large-scale needs as far as gas transmission out of the region. So whether that's expanding existing pipeline systems or looking at new builds to new markets for North Dakota gas will be the next steps.
Kringstead says a new processing plants will soon come online, and that will provide some help for a while. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This week on Away with the Words, we dabble in the world of opera.
In this opera, I play a character named Dick Johnson, who is a bandit. And he's caught out by a gang of miners, and the miners are about to hang him.
Join us.
Well, listen, my next opera, I'm going to be eaten by a whale. So I think I'd rather be hanged.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
That teletype machine in the background says it's time to talk to our news director, Dave Thompson, about the week's big stories. And one of the biggest stories happened early in the morning right here outside our office in downtown Fargo.
That was a very odd story. A reporter friend of mine who happened to be on scene called me at 4:30 this morning to tell me this was going down, said you probably are your Fargo staff are going to probably have a hard time getting into the office because there was police tape everywhere, and there was still chasing somebody. And he said it was a real interesting scene down there.
A lone male gunman was shooting with a pistol, a handgun.
Right, and he had a sight on it with a laser sight.
Yeah,
right.
And he fired into buildings. There was a bullet hole in the skyway glass that connects our office to the Radisson, which was also the scene of some of this. And it was a melee, but apparently the fellow is in custody. He's known to police. He has a history. He's 54-year-old Henry Aiken of Fargo. So.
And didn't the incident start when he actually crashed his car into the Gate City building?
Well, apparently he jumped out of the car, and the car kept going. And there was a police officer, we should mention this, who was injured during this incident.
Right. And he was the commander on scene at the time,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. This was a rifle accidentally discharging, and it went into his hand. This is Sergeant Matt Istebo. So he's got a painful and serious injury, but it's not life-threatening.
Yeah, and thank God for that. Yeah. That's for sure.
But
excitement in downtown. When he told me about what was going on, I thought, wow. We haven't had an incident like that I don't think we've ever had an incident quite like that.
Well, that was one for the books.
That is.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the director of North Dakota's medical marijuana program saying
that the process of establishing the state's marijuana dispensaries is almost done.
It's almost done. And then I think they've got one more left. And when that's done, they're going to be concentrating, too, on the grow centers to see if they're actually, you know, doing, you know, they're coming along. It sounds like they are coming along.
And apparently that they're growing enough to meet the need so far.
Right, right, so far. Now, there was some concern raised at, at an interim committee. At least legislators were concerned about what happens to the medical marijuana industry should North Dakota voters pass recreational marijuana. And there's no really good answer on that at this point.
Well, there are lots of places where they both exist.
Right.
There are medical marijuana dispensaries because it's a different form of the
And you have to go
substance.
Through different hoops, yes.
Yeah. But I've seen them on the same street in certain cities. I was also intrigued by the number that you had here, that doctors have approved more than 1,700 requests by patients looking to be eligible to buy the products. And
right.
That number is apparently continuing to go up.
It is. And it started out kind of slow but has gained momentum as people are discovering more dispensaries closer. So, yeah, they're expecting it to go quite a bit further.
Okay.
On that.
Well, let's talk about natural gas capture. The Department of Mineral Resources has been talking about this?
That's right. There was a hearing in Bismarck today, packed hearing room, with a lot of the people who are producing natural gas or who are the midstream companies who are, you know, transporting the gas to where it's needed. And there was a lot of discussion about what do you do, because one of the sticks that the Industrial Commission has over companies, if they have excessive flaring, is to ratchet back on production of oil. Nobody really wants to do that, but right now North Dakota is not meeting its voluntary goals for gas capture. So there's some discussion there about what needs to happen. A couple of things came out of that I understand. We've got some new gas processing plants coming online that's going to help temporarily, but the more oil we produce, the more the natural gas goes up. So there's talk about other pipelines maybe taking the gas out of North Dakota. And one thing, and I haven't reported on this yet because I'm looking into it, there was some talk about the Northern Border Pipeline, which is the big gas pipeline that comes out of North Dakota. Right now, it isn't carrying all North Dakota gas. It's carrying partially Canadian gas. And there might be an attempt to make that an all North Dakota gas pipeline. That'll help at least some.
I should also mention that we talked to an entrepreneur by the name of Mark Chris yesterday about his company, which is Geofinancial Analytics. This is a company that uses remote sensing, specifically satellites with the appropriate sensors, to determine if methane is being released from an oil and gas production field.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being to use the marketplace to regulate the industry. We'll play a good chunk of that discussion on Main Street Weekend this Sunday morning at 10
Great.
Central.
And there are entrepreneurs who are looking at things like this to, A, try to get more of a handle on what is actually going on in the atmosphere. But also there's some talk about maybe using ethane, not methane, but ethane, to generate power.
Yeah.
There's already talk about that. And there's also talk about having some of this natural gas that's captured on site to be used to power up the pumps. And I know that's being talked about. And there's some other things. And, of course, the other big thing that everybody is really wondering if it's actually going to happen is petrochemicals.
Yeah. That is a big deal. But then I'm thinking North Dakota, you know, decades ago there was a state bank, a state mill and elevator. Should there be a state gas plant?
that actually has been brought up on a couple of discussions I've had with some of the members of the industry. And basically you hear that more from the smaller producers, you know, not the Whiting Petroleums, but some of the smaller producers are saying maybe we should do that. And I remember when I talked to the Norwegian oil firm. They were talking about that too.
All right. Well, let's talk about the Legacy Fund, because a lot of the fund, of course, is based on oil and gas production in North Dakota. Incidentally, I just saw a number that sparked my memory here. The country of Norway pumps about 1.4 million gallons a day. That's less than North Dakota.
Less than North Dakota. Yet Norway... It's interesting. Norway's got that fund that basically funds everything.
That huge
in Norway.
Fund, yeah.
It's a huge fund because They've made some smart investments, and now it funds all their government facilities and also funds national health care, things like that, cradle-to-grave care for Norwegians. And that's all oil. And, of course, they've got, you know, North Sea oil, because that's where the drilling occurs offshore.
Well, Todd McDonald filed a story about the meeting in Fargo to discuss mm-hmm. what to do with the legacy fund. And, of course, it's the interest from the $6 billion that's been accumulated over 10 years now.
That's correct. And nobody wants to touch the principal at this point. And I understand that. If things really are get into dire straits, they probably can touch the principal. But they want to see what they can do from the proceeds from the legacy fund. But I thought it was interesting when they talked to the representative from Alaska, saying that Alaska has made a few errors perhaps. And really, North Dakota's fund has grown so much faster than Alaska's did,
wow.
which I thought was interesting.
That is great. Of course, it's all based on the price of oil. That can go up and down. And
it is commodity-based, and we've all got to remember that.
And in Todd's story, he reminded everybody that there were more ideas to spend the money than money. So.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. There's a lot of ideas out there.
Well, let's talk about a story that you covered earlier this week. Actually, just yesterday, an ethics group is pushing North Dakota lawmakers to adopt full disclosure of campaign donors over $200.
That's right. And the real driver for that is dark money. You know, some of these groups that are identified paid for by such and such fund.
Yeah.
But nobody knows who's giving to that fund. So North Dakota, in the constitutional amendment, in the first section of action in that amendment, there is talking about disclosing everybody $200 or more. And that means these funds would have to disclose who their donors are as well.
So where's the pushback on that?
Well, it's not overt because there's not a lot of that. But there is some concern that these are the remnants of the Citizens United decision.
Uh-huh.
And there's some interesting arguments that are being brought up about First Amendment rights, which you can argue that, I guess. But also because, you know, Citizens United has said that corporations are people, then there's really a concern that we won't get to the information. However, Montana passed a law that said, okay, if you're an outside group, one of these dark money groups, and you're involved in Montana politics, if you want to send flyers or get people to vote in the last few weeks of the campaign, that is just before the mail ballots go out, you have to disclose everything. And according to the Montana representative who I talked to who was there, all that dark money dried up.
Ah.
And he said, and he's a former Republican state representative, and he said that he was glad to see that because it put the elections more in the hands of local people.
Well, it's nice to think that people are looking around the corner at what money can do or exactly. not do. Last time there was an election, I put a dollar on the bureau, and it did not go out and vote. So I'm just always wondered about the Citizens United decision, and I suspect it'll be chatted about for a long time yet.
I think you're right.
There was a second Supreme Court hearing on the Davis Refinery. This is that Meridian Energy project that seems to have been trying to start now for years.
Yes, that's the one that's going to be built near Belfield, North Dakota. And the concern among environmental groups and some other groups that like the people who support national parks is that that's being built too close to a national park. So the first hearing concerned DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality, and the air quality permit they issued. The second one had to do with siting of the issue. And we have an interesting siting law in North Dakota because if you are at 50,000 barrels a day or above, you have to go through a full Public Service Commission siting process. If it's less than 50,000 barrels, well, then you don't. And the refinery is proposed to come in at 49,500. So there's some concern that, you know, because they were talking earlier about two phases, 27.5 plus another 27.5, which would put it over that 50,000 threshold. And when the DEQ issued its air quality permit, it said, let's just put it at 55,000 so you don't have to come back a second time. Well, that was when they were still talking two phases. The current plan, according to the company, is 49,500. But that can change.
Okay. I guess it begs the question, why didn't they just go through this longer process 2 years ago?
That is a very good question. That was asked at the hearing. You know, why didn't you just go through the process? And, well, they didn't think they had to. And there's a bit of a cost to go through that process because you have to get expert witnesses and lawyers and do that type of thing.
Well, let's talk about an alternative energy, wind power, and now what to do with wind turbine blades, Dave.
When I heard the Public Service Commission Chairman Brian Crosius say that right now of the turbines that are on our wind farms, 25 million tons.
Wow.
I thought that was amazing. And a lot of these things wear out. As a matter of fact, the blades will wear out before the actual turbines wear out.
Well, these are fiberglass blades.
These are fiberglass blades. They're heavy. They're big. And fiberglass is a solid waste.
Yeah, so it doesn't deteriorate too fast.
No. So there are some things they've done, and not very many has happened in North Dakota, but a few landfills have accepted them. They have to cut the blades apart and then put them together. So it's probably less of a footprint, but it's a concern in other states as well.
Well, the devil's always in the details.
It sure is.
We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Thanks,
Thank
Dave.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate it.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien, and this week, Matt, you went to a sequel of a very popular horror movie from decades ago.
Yeah, a long after sequel, and I'll get to that in a few minutes as to why that may have hindered the box office. We're not sure. That's kind of the story within the story. Dr. Sleep, written by Stephen King, sequel to The Shining. Many years later, if you've seen the trailer, you know the plot. Danny Torrance is all grown up. The little boy from The Shining who, you know, had visions and could see things and had certain powers, you know, driving around the Overlook Hotel on his little big wheel in the Stanley Kubrick 1980 film. He's grown up. He's played by Ewan McGregor, who's about the same age. That's a good casting here. As about the same age that Danny would be the boy in the film, in the Kubrick film. But he has a lot of issues from his grown-up times as to what happened at the Overlook. You know, his father freezing to death in the maze, Jack Nicholson. He's an alcoholic. He struggles with a lot of things. So he's kind of a guy in search of something, but he's not sure what. And that something happens in the form of a cult group of people that are immortal or try to be immortal called the True Knot. That's K-N-O-T, the True Knot. And they're led by a marvelous villain called Rose the Hat, played by Rebecca Ferguson, and she almost steals this movie. She is a really good villain. She's creepy. She's scary. But like all good villains, Doug, she sort of sucks people in with her charisma, and that's what makes an interesting villain, and she is truly the villain. They need to survive, Doug, based on feeding off of young kids who have the Shining gift. So they seek out these kids. And then they dispose of them, they do with them what they will, and they gain powers by kind of breathing the pain that comes out of them. That's the best way I can describe it. There are some horrifying scenes. This is R-rated. Don't take the kids to this. I like this film in general. Mike Flanagan, the director, I do know him. I want to put that out there to people. I've met him twice at the Fargo Film Festival. He's become a big deal now in the horror genre.
He wrote the screenplay.
He wrote the screenplay. He edited the film. He directed the film. He is a former student of Tom Brandau. So Mike does a good job of, I think, serving both masters, Stephen King and Stanley Kubrick, with this film. As you know, Doug, Stephen King famously hated the movie of The Shining.
Yes.
Yeah, the ending was changed by Kubrick. I also have a theory that there is some professional jealousy maybe going on here because Kubrick put his fingerprints on that movie. It became a Stanley Kubrick movie, not a Stephen King novel. And maybe King has some jealousy to that. I don't know. You know, Kubrick was an auteur. But what Flanagan does very well here is he serves King, the novelist, And he also serves Kubrick. There are many homages to Kubrick's film in this film. Long, slow dissolves, just like we had in the original. High arcing crane shots, overhead shots of cars driving, like we had in the original. The film score, very Kubrickian in nature. So there are homages to Kubrick, and Flanagan is a huge Kubrick fan. So I think he really towed the line between being faithful to Stephen King and also paying tribute to Kubrick's film. What also helps this film is a phenomenal performance by a little girl named Kylie Curran, who plays Abra. She has very similar powers to Danny Torrance, and she's able to contact him. And that's really where the film drives from there, is that he finds his purpose in life is to help this little girl defeat the True Knot. And that's where the plot gets very, very interesting.
Does Red Rum show up?
Oh, yes. Red Rum shows up. The film is a tad long. I will say that at 2.5 hours, there was a lot of exposition at the beginning because you're going back. You have to explain things for people that haven't seen The Shining. This is a 39 years later sequel to a film. Kubrick fans will be very happy with a third act. That's all I will say about that. But as you can tell from the trailer, there's a shot of Ewan McGregor looking through the hole in the door where Jack Nicholson famously, you know, axed it and said, here's Johnny. So we do know that the Overlook Hotel is a character in this film that will emerge at some point.
Does the furnace come back too? The furnace had a role?
You'll have to go and see.
Okay.
Some really good scenes in Alcoholics Anonymous too. They have some really good scenes there where he's going through his rehab. Bruce Greenwood plays the leader of that group. Those are some good scenes as well. As I said, the film is maybe a tad long, but I did like it. The story within the story is why it only made $14 million at the box office over the weekend. This is one of those things that's baffling. A lot of times I have an answer for why a film is good, why it's not, why it made money. This one is baffling. They were hoping for $25 to $30 million, and it did $14 million. Couple reasons maybe. The sequel comes so long after The Shining. That could be what's going on. It might have been released at a bad weekend, Veterans Day weekend. I'm not sure what's going on here because the film is good. It's not great, but it's good. It's a solid piece of filmmaking by Flanagan. It's terrifying in parts. He gets a good performance out of Ewan McGregor, gets a great performance out of Rebecca Ferguson and Kylie Curran. So this is baffling, and it's got Hollywood nervous. Why a film like this, with all the credentials, and a lot of people have seen The Shining. They have seen that movie. It's a film that people are familiar with. It's a Kubrick film, and I just don't understand why. And it was heavily promoted. I mean, I saw trailers to this for 3 months.
Yes.
It's very baffling. I don't know if the length hurt it or the length of time between the sequel and the original. We're not sure.
Well, the entertainment industry pundits will be pondering that, and I guess that is intriguing that you mentioned it.
But as always, Doug, if a film doesn't make money, it doesn't mean it's not good. I think it's a solid piece of filmmaking, maybe not quite as good as Midsommar this year, which is another great horror film. But again, it continues a great year for horror films.
All right. Well, it's time for Oscar trivia. Last week, I asked a question that I thought would baffle you, but I'd actually asked it before.
Okay.
That's how, I really do try to stump you.
I know you do.
So I went online today, and I think I found one that might stump you.
Oh, boy.
Let's just try this one out. Which Best Actress in a Supporting Role winner had the least amount of screen time in the winning role?
Beatrice Straight in Network.
Oh, that took a long time.
1976.
How long was she on?
She has a one-scene screaming fest where she screams at William Holden, basically, who plays her husband.
5 minutes and 40 seconds.
Yep.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
On the next Radio Lab.
A big fat middle finger to the hockey establishment.
Hockey fans, take back the vote.
Let's really drop a stink bomb in the room.
Vote somebody in who just does not belong.
Giving the league's most hated player.
This guy is a predator.
I'm going to put my fist through your face.
Objectively bad at hockey.
His Cinderella moment.
Everything else goes away and you just start playing hockey.
That's on the next Radio Lab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain. Right here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for November 15th. On this date, in 1917, the Hope Pioneer newspaper ran a picture of a check on the front page. The check was in the amount of $21.25.
It was made out to the American Tobacco Company. The headline asked, "Do you have an interest in this check?" The check, said the newspaper, meant comfort for the boys in France. The rather modest sum represented 85 smoking kits. Cigarettes, pipes, and smoking paraphernalia were the most requested comfort items. One British soldier said his men could endure anything if they had tobacco. He said some men were reduced to smoking tea, brown paper, and leaves of trees. Nurses routinely offered cigarettes to wounded and sick men in hospitals. Cigarettes became part of a soldier's standard rations, an iconic image of World War I. It gave soldiers a sense of camaraderie, even if they didn't speak the same language. It was considered the height of kindness to offer a cigarette to a wounded enemy soldier. Pipes began to fall out of favor. German soldiers were known for their elaborate ceramic pipes, decorated with the regimental insignia. But they were fragile and easily broken. It was easier to light a cigarette than pack and light a pipe, and it was easier to send packs of cigarettes to the boys at the front. There had been efforts to ban tobacco use prior to the war. Organizations like the Red Cross and the YMCA had supported a ban, but during the war, those organizations changed their tune, providing the troops with cigarettes. It was a way to offer some measure of comfort to soldiers far from home. During the war, there was a noticeable increase in smoking among soldiers of all nationalities. Tobacco companies took advantage of this marketing windfall. Bull Durham sold its entire production to the U.S. War Department. Tobacco companies geared advertising towards civilians, encouraging them to buy cigarettes and send them to the boys. After the war, cigarette smoking was widely accepted, as it was associated with the soldiers who fought for their country. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
What are the long-term effects on members of a community after an immigration raid? For one woman's family, it's the loss of a breadwinner.
Hunger, poverty, possible homelessness, and she was homeless after the raid.
The aftermath of deportations, also analysis of the first public impeachment hearings, that and all the news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, adopted children may feel like they're different, especially when their birth and adopted parents have different cultural, religious, or racial backgrounds. Artist Brad Kallhammer's birth parents are Native. His adoptive parents are not. On Monday, we'll talk to him about how he explores his experience in art. A Nation of One is currently on display at the Plains Art Museum. So we hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we invite you to check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.